Welcome to Polycast, the civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host.
Master Mishu.
We're all dressed for radio here, it's okay.
Oh man, if you said that to some podcasters about comparing this to radio, oh my gosh, you want a debate? Flame War? Go there. Wow.
Well, I suppose, yes, we are not radio. Objectively not, fine, but...
I use the radio reference as a gateway to explain what podcast is. You take something that people know to help explain something that they don't know.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to 185. Introducing your co-host, Daniel Quick.
Your scrambled maps come with your choice of sides for added protein, Gods and Kings, and Brave New World, and for an infusion of fiber and assortment of additional DLC.
The Mean Team. Imagine.
Dan worked on that intro for like an entire week.
My.
You know the fall patch that we talked about last episode? It's been released.
Woo!
There, covered.
You already have it, so done.
Yeah, well, this change we were talking about are official.
Makalua.
Oh, hi.
Sup, lady? You're late. I stole your coffee.
Nuh-uh, I got it right here. Ha.
No.
Nuh-uh.
Nuh-uh.
Don't make me turn this podcast around.
Too late for that.
Turn the podcast around.
No.
Okay.
You're about to have to feel percussion on your head.
Ooh, Mackie's going to play a song.
Mackie's going to touch me. Okay.
Cool. Really?
And I'm your guest co-host, Master Mishi, and I pwned a noob, and I liked it.
I bet they liked it, too.
I've been listening to the Polycast for a while now, ever since maybe episode 80, and I'm a big fan. So it's
wow.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be joining you.
That's good to hear. Two new map packs coming to Civ 5. One of them is Scrambled Continents. So you're going to get things like Africa, Eastern Asia, North and South America, Western Europe, Middle East, Antarctica. That one should be interesting. There'll be, like, not too much land. And new scripted maps for small continents, Oceania, and one including all of Earth's continents. Hey,
hey. Brand new Earth map. Not stepping. Now, the question is, did they get rid of that stupid mountain tile between North and South America?
Yeah, that really needed to be there. That, especially with the way that the mechanics worked. God, that was terrible. And then the other one is the Scrambled Nations map pack,
where you scramble up your nations and serve them with a side of back bacon.
These map packs include authentic geographic outlines with randomized interiors, giving players even more ways to one more turn it. Yeah, I paraphrased that.
Mm-hmm. The Scrambled Continents map pack came out on October 15th, and we only have to wait until the 5th of November to get the Scrambled Nations map pack. Although I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of even really enthusiastic Civ players have this on their wish list waiting for the next Steam sale.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're both $5, and you start doing the math on Civ 5, the two expansion packs, existing DLC, and I know you get a lot of replayability out of it, and I know it's kind of spread out over an extended period of time, but it really does add up, these death by a thousand nips to your wallet.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it works out quite economical when you consider the amount of time you're investing in the game.
Yeah, me too.
Even more economical if you wait till the first Steam sale.
Yeah, exactly. Me too, I'll just write it off. It's a business expense.
I love playing the Earth maps for the immersive, kind of historical, role-playing aspects. I mean, a lot of high-level multiplayer, online players, I don't think they'll be that interested in it.
One of the best things about the Scramble for Africa scenario is the fact that the map is random on the inside.
Random elements, always good.
Yeah, random elements you might actually want, as opposed to buying, like, a mass-produced, pre-packaged confectionery or something.
Yeah.
I had to relate it back to food, because that's my theme from my intro, see? See what I did? No.
Scrambled confectionery?
the lead producer on Civ 5 Gods and Kings and Brave New World, Dennis Shirk, has said publicly, "I won't make the call on whether you like them or not. We hope you do, but we've done some pretty cool stuff with these." And yeah, I think for most people, the issue isn't even so much I'm interested or I'm not interested, but again, what is with this price point?
Yeah.
Although, quite honestly, it shouldn't surprise any of us at this price point because it is consistent.
Yeah. Oh, and there's new scripted maps for small continents and Oceania. Small continents map scripts always sucked. In the 1 in 100 times that you actually get a map that actually does have a bunch of small continents on it, then it was good. But normally it'd be, I don't know what was wrong with the map script, but it seemed to create all these small continents and then overlap them so that you have one giant Pangaea.
Yeah, I remember playing many dual small continent maps and just it was spawning on the same small continent. It's ridiculous. It's like the most intense early war ever. And that's what you want. You want your own continent. I believe there's an argument that it's not really so original because you can muck about with the sea level on the islands and the existing maps.
And I think 2K could have done a little bit better in terms of the promotion of this because if you go to on the Steam store and you look at screenshots, you can't see all of the maps that you're talking about examples of. So a forum user on 2K, Knight Baya, actually did some of 2K's work for them for free. And you can see screenshots of all of the maps. That's still probably not going to be good enough to get, I think, a lot of people to buy it at the regular price. Why do I keep coming back to that?
Although it's funny, I was looking at Civ Fanatics, and some of the comments just seem really odd to me. Like, what? They're making another DLC? Why? I thought they were done with DLC. No. DLC before expansions was considered bad, but once expansions are done, DLC is okay. And it's not the first map pack they've put out. If the first one sold horribly, then they probably wouldn't have put out another one.
No, see, I think what they're saying is that Firaxis and 2K should have made a choice. You either have DLC before an expansion pack or after. And even though it's better than after, since you did it before, you can't have your cake and eat it too. There's another food reference. Look at how I just... It's almost like I know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag nom nom nom.
And if you forget to put it on your wish list, you could just check your community updates. And if you have a lot of people on your Steam list that play Civ 5, and suddenly you see so-and-so now owns, so-and-so now owns, now owns, now owns, it might be a sign that it is on sale.
Possibly.
Possibly. Maybe.
Just imagine one poor person in the multiplayer lobby with that DLC checked, nobody joining.
Actually, that's one thing. I tried at one point to use Scramble for Africa map on multiplayer, but the multiplayer side doesn't take the scripts very well. Now you can actually do it properly, so they obviously found a way to move the scripts over effectively.
Yeah.
Candice Albinus says in the chat, or maybe the early DLC, downloadable content, was just to distract us from the problems at first. So does that mean if they're releasing DLC afterwards that there are still problems they're trying to cover up? Let the theories run wild, people.
Conspiracy.
Troll.
No, I thought the Mongol DLC was to distract us. Here's a free save. Please stop looking at the belly crap.
But there's new maps, and they're shiny and new.
Border clashes, because you see they're in quotation marks, so I have to say the quotation marks. Normally, opening posts, when I read them, I abbreviate them. But I kind of assign this topic to myself, for those wondering. Usually I say, this is my draft suggestion for people to introduce topics, and most people are like, I'd really like to change the topic, but the path of least resistance is to just smile and nod at Dan. So I still get this topic. It comes from Captain Patch. Captain Patch, joined by Commander Hotfix. Wait, no, there's no Commander Hotfix that I'm aware of. Throughout history, empires have chafed against each other without actually going to war. Just units from two different nations, each thinking that even if they weren't within their borders, they were within their sphere of influence, and therefore the other unit was trespassing. And you can imagine the air quotes here right now around sphere of influence. This situation seems apropos to Civ 5 because of the countless occasions where AI opponents make you want to punch its lights out. Settlers way the hell from their home, insisting on building a city right up next to one of your fledgling cities. It happens often enough, don't settle near our borders just doesn't cut it. So much simpler to just attack the settler before it becomes an unwanted squatter. But is it enough of provocation to warrant going to full-fledged war? Or, my favorite, in the masochistic sense, I've just spent 4 turns pounding down a barbarian encampment, bleeding myself to less than 25% strength. But just before I'm about to move into that empty encampment, when pops an AI scout or brute that just jumps in and steals the prize that I bled for. He's a dirty thief. It's okay to just summarily execute a thief, isn't it? Why should I be obligated to go to war just for executing a thief? These things all occur out on the frontier, many leagues away from the capitals filled with politicians and diplomats. Sure, the event may make for some diplomatic tension, more than that if it happens frequently, but do these occurrences mandate a full-blown declaration of war? All quote-unquote from Captain Punch. There's a fair bit of discussion in this thread, and I think it boils down to, and some users in this thread said that, you have to make a choice. Is it worth going into a full-blown war, meaning that either, I'm not really certain I'm in a position to defend myself. Could the tide turn against me and they go on the offensive if I declare war? Or am I really declaring war not because I want to take the civilization out, but I want to take that unit out that just wronged me and send a message to the Civ not to do that again and then wait for the heat to simmer down and eventually get peace or just have a cold war and just have this quote-unquote perpetual state of war for a while because you're making a statement. You're sending a message not to just to that Civ, but other Civs as well. Don't piss me off.
That poor barbarian AI, you know, he's come in helping out the human player, and all he gets is this hassle, you know, and no appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
I'd appreciate them not pillaging all my crap.
My gold, my barbarian plunder.
Yeah, you wrote your name on it and everything.
Yeah, it's part of being a barbarian.
That's it. That's what they're there to do. I mean, it happened to me today. It is frustrating.
Wait, this was in-game, right, or in real life?
Yeah, this is in-game, right.
Yeah, he had a stockpile of gold somewhere. Somebody came along with
it. Okay, I'm just, you know.
Barbarians came out of the desert nearby. And
just clarifying.
Yes, I can clarify. That was in-game. What was the suggestion? What does he want? He wants to be able to kill the unit but not go to war. So
it's
about trying to play the diplomacy game. For me, of course, you kill the settler and you go to war. I mean, that is a war game. Go play theme park, you know, if it bothers you.
I think it's more the, I want to brand them thieves for stealing my stuff. Except on the opposite side, it's, what? We're not thieves. Why are you attacking us? That's war. Not, as somebody put it, talking about, well, you know, the AI has to attack me after I pillage their aluminum. They can declare war on me after I take their little city. They can declare war on me for, you know, whatever. No. Like, you want to go do that stuff, you declare war on them.
Yeah, I don't think this is really viable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with something like to take his idea and throw it out the window and then make up one of my own.
That was a very indirect way of saying
sounded pretty direct to me.
He's got some gripes and there's ways to fix them without letting you just randomly pillage the entire AI out before you can declare war. The settler thing, I could see you send a military unit over to a settler and say, you know, instead of declaring war, you tell them to go away. And you just have a button that says, you know, get off my land. And if the AI chooses to blatantly ignore you, well, then you have to decide to go to war or not. But maybe the AI could go, oh, well, they're going to attack us. So I don't feel like getting in a fight over this particular settler. So maybe I will walk it away. And then you can, you know, get rid of settlers without actually having to go to war. But it might, you know, mean some little aggressiveness on your side. So lose a little diplomacy, possibly. Because don't settle near our borders just rarely actually works. And then you can have the border war style thing out in, you know, uncontrolled territory, where basically if you have the units there, it's your territory. Because, you know, my units are on the land, therefore it's mine.
Many a time in MP, you and the enemy are both trying to settle a particular luxury or a natural wonder. You both plant the city and you're both trying to click race to buy the tiles and then you get beaten. And there's nothing worse than that feeling. It's just insta-war from that. It's just like a grudge war.
Yeah, well, of course. But that's two people deciding on that versus you being able to walk over, pillage their city, and then go, well, we're not actually at war. Like, you didn't declare war on me, so this is fine.
Maybe you could do something that's like the guarantees, like when they tell you not to settle near there, and if they do settle near there within a certain number of turns, and it's an auto-declare war, and the AI has to think about that?
It's possible.
As in, they take the Diplo hit for declaring on you.
Mm-hmm. And if they settle near you within X number of turns, then that's them declaring war, because there's something. Some sort of a form of a huge Diplo hit for that.
Yeah, in theory, there's a Diplo hit, but humans don't get little counter. This one
well, yes, yes, we're talking about against the AI here.
Yeah.
That's the issue, isn't it? He wants to be able to prevent the settler coming into really neutral territory, but what he considers his, without getting that Diplo hit. Am I reading it right?
Yeah, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like they have a city like two or three tiles over, and the AI wants to settle right next to him. It's like, no.
But that could also lead to a different mechanic altogether of tile claiming. Like, this is mine. I have claimed it.
Yeah, EK834 in the thread kind of goes into that a little bit. Talks about the possibility to buy, sell, or exchange, or otherwise seize by force land tiles. And I'm thinking, well, okay. I mean, you can kind of do that now. It's called war. That's kind of an exchange, air quotes. But he talks about, like, war could be declared after seizing tiles that lets a civ send a trade route to another and you refuse them open borders. You could be offered, like, a big sum to let the AI control a source of 4 iron, for example. So I think maybe in a way what he's talking about is rather than declare war, and I'm kind of inferring this, you move your units into territory that is owned by somebody else, and then you sit there and you say, because I've got these units sitting here, you're going to give me these particular tiles because I control them, because possession is 9/10 of ownership kind of a thing. Really, to me, that's just, I've declared war, I've moved my units into your territory, I'm sitting here, maybe then, you know, trying to attack your city, I don't want to be near where your city can bombard, for example, I want you to come to me, but I'm in your territory, and let me pick you off one by one. No, that's a type of war, you declare war, war takes different forms. Sometimes it's about taking cities, sometimes it's about just destroying the units, sometimes it's about pillaging improvements. And sometimes it's just, again, you stole my camp that I cleared, so I'm going to destroy it before you can do that, or you went ahead and did that, and I'm not very happy about that. Or you forward settled on me, and my response is, declare war, take out that city, stop, wait for a time that I can declare peace, or just quite honestly, however long it takes to get them to declare peace, or, you know, what have you. And I don't really see a need to change anything that we're already doing. I will caveat that. Other than I do agree that the, you know, don't settle cities near us, that's kind of a reactionary thing. So I'm quite fine with something a little bit more proactive. The game recognizes, you've got these troops and it's like a settler, like right near your borders, to be able to say that in advance. Perhaps I could see that. But other than that, now you're just declaring what war actually looks like.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm talking about tile claiming, I'm meaning out in neutral territory. So it doesn't get covered by your borders, per se, but you could, like, claim that, you know, this section of land is mine to settle later, et cetera, and then you can have little wars over who's claiming too much land.
That sounds like an opportunity to reintroduce colonies.
Yeah.
Not necessarily how colonies worked before, but just a concept of a colony. Yeah. We think we might want to turn this into a permanent settlement. You don't like it? Come get it.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah, say you've got borders, there's a luxury or a resource tile just outside your border in your opponent's land. I think there might be a case for saying that, you know, in a situation where you can't take the city, but you've got some units that are occupying that particular tile that you want to claim, that given enough turns, you could flip that particular tile, just that tile, or just the tiles that your units have claimed, and then you can send your worker in, improve that resource or luxury, without having to take the city.
Yeah, see, that leads to all sorts of abusive things, like letting a civ, I don't know, the Shoshone, take lots of land, get really big, and then instead of killing them, because, you know, taking cities is bad. You get a lot of warmongering penalties. You just stand outside their city bombardment range at, you know, 3 and beyond, claim all of their tiles, so now they only have 2 hexes worth around, and then, oops, look, I just took everything, and I didn't even have to fight for it.
Yeah, I agree. It's probably, I mean, if you've got that many units, you could probably just kill the city, and it's not an issue. So it probably is only a very small amount of situations where that would occur.
Trading tiles back and forth in peace, like for peace treaties and stuff like that, that could be in the game. So it's like, yeah, you have a really crappy city here, but I need these couple tiles of water so that I can get my boats in and out of the area, that sort of thing. I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to actual, like, trading for tiles, as long as cities automatically owned a certain number of hexes around so that you couldn't abuse the AI and leave them with, like, no tiles around a city.
Yeah, the bottom line is you've just got to take the city, so just man up and spam those units.
Pretty much. But for stuff that's not currently controlled by culture borders, there's definitely more that can be done there.
E-E-E-boy
is asking whether or not, and, you know, there's a poll attached, should we have a promotion that carries a -% attack against cities for the archery unit? He goes on in his first post basically to say, in the new patch, gold returned friendly AI cash ratios got fixed, tourism got improved, which blah, 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 blah. But the archery units have been used in both offense and defense since Gods and Kings for early war, so it'd be great so they carry a promotion that has -% attack versus cities, just like horse units. That way, siege units are more valuable and important to bring into the offensive war, and archery units should be mainly as support units to kill other units. What do you think? Yes, and we can move on.
What?
Duh. Basically, archery units, the basic archer, any unique unit attached to it, the composite bow, every single crossbow, those three types of units and whatever should be hit with a -33% versus cities. And the main reason I say that is just because the way city defense grows over time and with the various buildings, you could easily have situations from the very early game where your archer unit has equal to or just shy of the city defense number. And that's not very useful for catapults that are entirely built to do that. So yeah, -33% promotion that is already exists in the game. So the amount of work that to be done is just adding the horse unit promotion for the minus attack over to the archery, three archery units. It would actually balance out the early game by quite a bit.
The only notable difference, and the horse units comparison is a good one, because we talked about in Vanilla Civ 5, let's just go on a horse unit rampage and take city after city after city. And I think there's a infamous account of the Mian team doing just this on a higher difficulty level. You know, the notable difference with this, of course, is that horse units can actually take cities. Archery units cannot. I'm not saying that it should not be modified so that there's a penalty for attacking cities. Just to point out, it's not quite exactly the same as horse units.
It is actually quite the same as horse units because
very similar.
You can just see LPs everywhere or all throughout the entire Civ universe interweb land. The primary strategy for anybody going to go to war says go to composite bows, build them, mass spam them, and if you happen to bring a single melee unit along, even a scout, use those to take cities. Otherwise, just mass those archery units, and that is the primary way to go. Why? Because archery units do very well versus cities, and they're really good versus units. And they don't require time to prepare. No point movement point wasted trying to set up. They can move and shoot on the same thing. They are the ultimate early game war unit.
They also get defensive terrain bonuses.
Yeah, they get all sorts of fun stuff. So yeah, they are not meant to be versus cities. I mean, that's the whole point of having a siege line. Now, granted, as soon as you hit the Gatling gun and everything beyond, city defense strengths are so high compared to what those the Gatling gun and all the rest can do that it's not necessary to have a negative against those particular units because I have 30 attack. The city has 80 defense. Oh, well, you're already being nerfed. And, of course, you don't want to drop the combat strength of the archery units because then that means that they'll be completely useless against units as well. So the combat strength does need to be there, but, boy, definitely hit the nail on the head.
Meh, I'll just build a couple extra composite bows.
Yeah.
Yeah, even if it did get, like, the 33% nerf, that would just be my solution to it because the composite bows are just faster moving and quicker to get in. And you can shuffle them back if they get too injured a lot faster than you can because catapults take that extra time to set up and everything.
And they upgrade to a crossbow as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they need to be nerfed.
Don't nerf my archery, man.
Absolutely. Got to learn. You want to take a city, got to use a siege unit.
I do that later on with artillery.
If you have to wait till cannons, Before you start using siege units, there's a problem in the game.
Don't have to. It's just quicker.
Well, some people on the thread have suggested that in addition to a nerf to archery units, that siege units need to be given a buff. With the emphasis on catapults, and I suppose trebuchets too.
Yeah, Catfish mentions that, you know, they cost too much, get no cover from terrain, and easily destroyed. Yeah, okay, but they also have plus 200 or plus 300% versus cities. So that little number that they have is actually a massive number, and you only need a couple of them to shoot at a city to bring it down way faster. You need like half the number of catapults or less versus cities. And if you're getting them wiped out, then you're doing it wrong.
Well, yeah. Oh, there seems to be a Carpet of Doom problem. Let's move in the archery units. Carpet of Doom cleared? Good. Need to bombard city defenses? Catapults. Great. And then finish off with the melee. There you go. Combined arms.
Well, you should move your melee in first at the city and everything else. Start shooting at the melee units so that your siege units don't get shot. But, you know, that's just tactical things.
Yep.
I mean, what about if the hammers to build a catapult was reduced? So, I mean, they're expendable units. You expect them to get crushed, but you could just spam them a lot more.
Oh, yeah. I'd be fine with a cheaper catapult. It shouldn't cost, like, a huge amount.
I mean, as it is, if I expect a catapult to get a shot off, I'll usually build two and know that one is just going to get insta-killed before it gets shot, and then the other one gets the shot in. And that's the few times that I'll bring a catapult to an ancient or early classical era war.
Yeah, I would probably give it cover from terrain because they're hiding it. But then again, catapults and stuff like that, if you give them too much stuff, then they become, like, uber goofy.
Yeah, like when artillery was just totally overpowered a few patches ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to substitute one. Use this unit almost always with another unit to use this almost always. We've dealt with the horses. Now we're going to deal with the archery units. Let's not do that, too.
Yeah.
Early siege. Early siege, too.
Yeah, because you got to keep in mind, some of these things upgrade to stuff that does work, like cannons.
Now, in the thread, Fei Ling had said, took a completely different approach to this. Kind of looked away from nerfing archery units or even buffing siege units to, I'm starting to think the solution to all of this would be to reduce city combat strength but increase city hit points. So melee units do not get crushed that hard without even dealing much damage to a city, and range units would need longer to tear down a city. Okay, that would work, but the other solution here is it's simpler. It's not as complicated, and it's not going to require as much balancing concerns here either with what we're suggesting as opposed to this.
I mean, you want the rock, scissors, paper effect, don't you? You know, seed, but you expect it's going to get killed by, say, a horse unit, a mounted unit, but you just don't want it to get one shot by a city and an archery garrison.
Yeah, so maybe you should. That's kind of the problem. I mean, with the game mechanics and everything, that cities can shoot back, and the fact that combat strengths and this and that. I know melee units, you know, melee units are getting knocked out, but I haven't actually seen melee units really be that bad versus cities until the late game when everything gets high, or if, you know, somebody mass boosted. Not to mention they have this little promotion called Siege, where they get plus 50% of their combat strength added. Not to mention, they get defensive terrain bonuses and offensive terrain bonuses, so they can soak it up way better than anything else. So basically, if you try and make other adjustments, then you get into other such problems.
Well, yeah, and they too, it's like, oh no, I think my swordsman might be killed next turn because, you know, it's down into the yellow. Hey, look, there's an improvement I can move on to, and I can pillage it, and I can heal.
Yeah, there's that too. I mean, I'm not saying that dropping city combat strength by a little bit might not work. If you increase city hit points, all you're doing is adding turns to the siege. Adding a few extra turns to the siege may or may not cause people to use more siege engines to speed it up a lot, but it also might mean that they just bring in extra compsibo.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you drop the city strength, then if they do bring that extra compsibo, that compsibo is doing even more damage, because keep in mind, the amount of damage being done is based on the relative combat strengths. So if you reduce the city combat strength, then those compsibos are actually doing more damage. And if you increase city hit points by the amount of damage that those compsibos would do, then you've effectively changed the game for absolutely no reason, because it'll be the same in the end. The math obviously has to be worked out so that any adjustments have to be more than that. Then later, you have things called artillery that can shoot from 3 range and not even get touched. As history went by, different weapons of war became more useful or less useful depending on the situation. Oh, by the way, the poll, because we didn't even say what the poll numbers were. If you ignore the I have another idea, 65-41. So about 65-ish% in favor of the change.
Yeah. See, when you've got this yes, no, and then there's kind of this maybe, it's I have another idea can fall under either yes or no. It does hurt the poll's effectiveness, I must say. I understand why it's there, but it's like...
Even if you sum up I have another idea with no, because I mean, if they have a different idea, then they don't want your idea, the actual change is still winning. It'd be 65-56.
So this poll is valid, Dan.
The valid poll.
No, because I have another idea could include giving archer units a city attack penalty, but also a buff to siege units and or something like Fei Ling suggested.
Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? Either way, yes is still winning.
I don't think it's fair to assume that I have another idea should automatically go with no.
It shouldn't automatically, but even if you distribute it between the two, yes is still winning by quite a bit.
Still using bullcrapology, though.
It is bullcrapology. It's called statistics.
Lies, damn lies, and statistics, yes.
This I have another idea just dilutes the effectiveness of the poll in the first place, which I'm not necessarily saying was that strong to begin with. But
okay, we need to change Dan's mandatory poll plan with a different unit of measurement.
Oh, speaking of being useful or not so useful, depending upon changes to situations.
I say, is that a segue?
Segue. Sometimes they're useful, sometimes they're not.
But they're always fun to talk about.
Hey, it's Captain Thatch again. This time we're talking about mandatory unit retirement or upgrade, because he finds it really strange that you still have ancient scouts and archers still active when you advanced your game well into the information era. And he said, when do we think that governments would disband you? It's been hopelessly outclassed by the current tech. And then below, everybody kept coming up with the obvious guards and things that different countries still use, their old uniforms and weapons. You know, they're also trained in normal weapons, but they still use the other ones. I don't know. Yeah.
A country is not going to use the Swiss Guard on the front line. Just saying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he does point out that a lot of times it's people's, A, because they don't want to spend the gold to upgrade. That's a lot of the time it would be really expensive to get them upgraded. And B, sometimes they're just too damn useful. It's like, even when I get to Gatling guns, I don't necessarily want to upgrade the crossbows because crossbows can still fire from further away.
Yeah, anytime it's like mandatory player do mm-hmm. this, you're taking away the choice.
Or some abuse, depending.
Well, yeah, you could choose to abuse or not to abuse.
And people will choose to abuse.
No.
Yeah, that's...
No.
That's awful.
Wait, why would you want a mandatory retirement anyway? I just, how's that going to help? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Just to reduce the number...
AI.
Yeah, nerf the AI. Like, hey, look at you. You've got a lot of pike units still around, even though we're running around with tanks.
Poof.
Oh, you didn't have any horses around, so you couldn't upgrade them. Yeah. Oh, well.
We talked about air quotes earlier. There is a mandatory unit retirement if you don't upgrade them. They get killed by better units.
Very easy.
Yeah.
There you go. That's the retirement right there.
True. You run that ancient era regular archer past the city and poof. They're retired, all right.
I don't think that necessarily constitutes retirement per se, but it's true that you won't have them anymore.
Well, it's more than retirement. If retirement is included, you just get the bonus. Also, in air quotes.
At least you won't feel it long.
Yeah, I find myself building fresh units rather than upgrading, with gold harder to come by than hammers often.
You end up being selective. Yeah, if there's a particular promotion that you know is going to carry over, and I know we've also talked about this on the show, particularly, you know, with unique units, then okay, then it's worth putting the gold into, because you can't buy some of those upgrades like instantly, or build those instantly, and that's situational.
Yeah, yeah, or if you've got some of those archers you've been using since the ancient era that have a crap ton of promotions, they're worth the gold.
Yeah, you don't upgrade something that's got like one promotion on it or two promotions on it unless it's special. Only because, you know, if you built your barracks and armory, you can just build new and get them anyways.
It's certainly a case for keeping scouts around late game. I remember a classic MP abusive technique was just to have a carpet of doom of scouts and then artillery behind, and then an enemy would take your scout. Fine, it's a cheap unit, takes a turn to produce, and then you just counterattack. That's retirement.
Yeah, but that doesn't really work anymore because artillery kind of suck versus units now.
Yeah, but still, I mean, you can use it as a gambit unit. You know, the AI could come in, sweep in, take your scout, and then you can counter effectively. So they'll always have uses.
Well, except for the fact that scouts actually obsolete at scientific theory, so you can eventually not build them anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
well, having a carpeted doom of scouts when you have very little cold patroon coming in is a little harder to deal with now.
This thread is titled Airports Not Equal to City Connection. There's a question mark at the end of that. It's by T. Pangolin. Basically says, I apologize in advance if this has already been answered, but I thought I'd try my luck here. Feel free to move this to ideas and suggestions form if need be.
Did they?
Well.
Nope.
Okay.
No.
It's our ideas and suggestions now.
You know why he said that? He just wants to be an honorary Canadian. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Because he apologized. In advance.
You never know, Dan. It might be possible. One can always strive to achieve. Anyway, he says, I am just curious as to why airports don't currently act as a city connection like roads and harbors, regardless of contiguous tile ownership. It'd be an easier and sensical way to connect faraway territories to your empire if they happen to be inland or separated by other cities. Is it due to a balance issue to determine when and how the connection would be broken in times of war?
Well, I would say no, because they can't even figure it out for naval. Like, if you have both a road and a harbor, and the harbor's blockaded, but the road isn't, you're still blockaded.
Okay, then. Magically, the ships went onto the land and stopped me from driving down the road. Okay.
Yeah.
I wish it worked that way in Civ 4. You could have really screwed people with blockades back then.
Yep. To answer the question, because I think people have said it, in reality, airports are not city connections. I mean, they're tourist connectors. They move people around, small amount of people, and then they have some freight cargoes, but that's mostly just packaging. But no one really moves mass quantity of stuff all the time. Now, it has been individually done once or twice in history, but it's not a common thing. Otherwise, Canada would have, like, a really bustling north, because we do use a lot of airport stuff for getting up there, and there's only 50,000 people up there for, like, half the country. So it doesn't work very well as a concept. Some reality slipped in, I think, is the answer.
All the freight that gets moved by UPS doesn't count?
Nope.
Somehow I doubt that this is mostly junk. Really a reality-based thing. I think it's mostly a design limitation. Is why would you put this in when it has such a low chance of being meaningful to the outcome of the game and you're already struggling with trade routes as it is without adding an extra layer of complexity? I don't think any previous Civ title had allowed airports as a trade route either, if I'm not mistaken. I know Civ 4 did not.
According to Catfish, Civ 3 had city routes. Okay. So there we go. Something from Civ 4 got brought into Civ 5.
A lot of things from Civ 4 got brought into Civ.
Civ got brought into Civ. Come on.
Including some things that shouldn't have been, but that's another topic.
Yes, Dan?
I've been thinking about this for a while, listening to what other people have said, and of course what's also been said in the thread. To me, by the time you can construct an airport, we're in the atomic era. So it's in the 7th of 8 eras. And yes, I know airports already give some notable benefits, like it increases the air unit capacity now from 6 to 10, which was, of course, the limitation of the number of air units in the cities was just recently added, not so long ago. And yes, there is also a considerable tourism benefit to this as well. But given that we're talking as late in the game as it is, it would be, if you can, actually having a trade connection more desirable by road and or by harbors. I'm quite all right with airports generating a city connection. I think it would be very situational that you would decide that this would actually be beneficial to do that for that purpose, and it would happen late enough in the game, plus the fact that you're going to be taking 5 gold per turn in order to maintain that. I think that's fine. I think that helps for those particular cities that are going to be isolated that you do want to be able to connect. And how useful is that city really going to be if it's so limited anyway in terms of how it's connected to the rest of your empire? I don't think it's an issue. I'd be fine with it. I think it's better in gameplay than it has been like in reality. Because, I mean, a connection is a connection. We're not talking about the quality of the connection. Just the fact that a connection can exist in the first place. I'm fine with it.
Presumably only going to be useful for the few cities that are isolated, like you say, landlocked, no harbour. And then is there another way of connecting them through the another Civ's lands with open borders? Presumably he's just suggest a few occasions where you're at war with or you haven't got the open borders or the trade routes through. So that's the only way to get in.
So why did you go there in the first place?
Maybe you wanted to settle a resource.
Oh, that's exactly, yeah. What
I was wanted to build those crappy AI cities because there was some oil up in the landlocked or ice-locked tundra somewhere.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, Byzantine Bond actually poses an interesting question. He says, how would one blockade a city that's connected to a city capital via an airport? If there's no such way, then a city could have an unbreakable connection to a capital city. And Headcase had suggested perhaps an enemy having a fighter in intercept mode in range of the city.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you're at war.
Post-World War II Berlin had a similar situation, I believe, where the Americans shipped in a lot of food.
Yeah, but that was a one-time thing that didn't last for a huge amount of time, and it was the only place. It's not like they said, hey, you know what? This is cheap and easy. Let's do it everywhere.
Yeah. Which ties back into being situational, that you would want to have a city connected with an airport.
Yeah, but then it gets to everybody gets one, and then you'd kind of lose the concept.
Well, and say you're going to want an airport anyway, perhaps, maybe in those, not just your far-flung cities, but your closer cities, because it increases your air unit capacity. Like, there already is another reason to be constructing airports, even in cities that are not far-flung in a way.
Yeah, but the Berlin example is the exact opposite of what happens in-game. In the Berlin example, it cost a crap ton of money to move stuff in. They didn't make money off it. In-game, yeah. If you have a city connection, you only make money off of it. And you can get some happiness off of it or other stuff off of it. So it's a totally beneficial thing to do. And therefore, it means it's super cheap and easy. And that's not the case.
I think those Berliners were fairly happy to see the food parcels dropping.
Yeah, it's better than bombs, but it wasn't efficient. They didn't make money off it.
Well, it is true that when you make something that has no downside, it's probably not well placed in a strategy game, or like no better alternatives or whatever.
I don't think it would end up being overpowered.
Oh, I could then go and delete all my roads, and then I'm saving a crap ton of money on roads.
Yeah, there's your exploit right there.
Yep.
Yeah, fair point.
And why do I need railroads? Because, hey, look, I can go airport jumping from city to city. So that's even more money I just saved.
It's coming so late in the game, though. quite honestly, do you want to go to that effort to spend all that time to then get rid of your roads? And, you know, no.
I have workers standing around doing nothing by that point.
Why are your workers standing around doing nothing and costing all that gold per turn?
Because there's nothing left for them to do except for wait for the uranium to show up so I can nuke you.
So then why don't you save all that gold per turn and just construct a worker later on? It's not going to take you very long to be able to do that.
Yeah,
but
deleting all those roads are really cheap by that point. It's really quick. You just walk along the road going delete, 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 delete. So you can save more gold per turn by doing.
Now, the road is not just about the connection, though. It's also about the ability to move units more quickly along it.
Yeah, no, you've lost because I can airport jump from city to city, so that's way faster. And it's across the world.
But it's not infinite jumps per turn.
It's an infinite jump as far as the game matters.
You can only arrive one city at a time, I think.
It's whatever you can fill the area around the city with units.
Oh, well, yeah, see?
Although
nope, don't need roads.
It does chew up the movement of the individual unit, but doesn't actually slow you down any.
Certainly be a limit to, it's like, I've got a unit in this particular city that's got an airport, and then there's a city all the way over yonder, and I just want to, there should be a limit to how far you can hop. Then you have to do multiple hops.
Apparently not. Apparently planes can fly.
And keep going as far as they want.
Well, then that's a separate thing to be addressed. That's something against that as opposed to making airports required for a city connection.
Dan is against airplanes flying. Let's fix it.
No, I'm against it. This concept of, hey, airplane's not going to have to stop and refuel her. No. That's a whole separate issue. It's just city connections, though.
No, that's what mid-air refueling's for. They do it all the time.
That's right.
That comes later in the game, because that happened later in reality, that they wouldn't be able
to... Reality.
Reality.
You're making realism arguments here already, so I'm incorporating that, too.
Reality.
It works both ways.
I deny your reality, and replace it with my own.
Deny reality, full stop.
Well, that's your issue, not mine. So there you have it, listeners. Completely different takes on whether or not airports should require city connection. Decide for yourself.
Yeah, as Dan edits my side out of it.
I'm not going to edit your side out of it. I personally think that my argument is stronger. Then say your argument was weak. I just think my argument is stronger. We'll let the listeners decide.
Especially when his argument isn't there. Certainly then Dan's will to be stronger.
I do not need to eliminate Magin's argument to make my argument strong or stronger. It stands well on its own. And in fact, I think it stands stronger with Magin's arguments in there.
Uh-huh.
I'm perfectly confident in my arguments.
So, yeah, mid-air refueling started in the Korean War about the same time as airports become available in the atomic era. Boom. You've been canisted.
No, you can extract that in the game. Just because it worked in realism doesn't mean it's going to just shift that into the last era. It's a gameplay mechanic concern. Realism doesn't necessarily make good gameplay.
Exactly.
That's why realism arguments are a problem.
Speaking about making a strategy game.
We make strategy games? What?
No, we don't make strategy games. We talk strategy games. We're great critics.
No, we leave that to Paradox and Firaxis. This isn't our global on Games Radar.
Yeah, by the way, everybody else, you don't make strategy games.
Just saying.
You could call it a strategy game, but we know who the real strategy people are. Thomas Johansson, who's a project lead at Paradox, and talked to you, Ed Beach and Dennis Shirk from over at Firaxis, who we've had on before, to talk about their different approaches to games. So they have the examples of Civ and Europa Universalis here, which are, you know, they're both strategy, but they're really, really different.
This is an interesting article because two very well-known companies for strategy games, and all strategy games are not created equal. Strategy is already a segment, you know, of the gaming population, and then Paradox focuses, I think, even more on kind of like a more of a niche within strategy games where you get into a lot of the micromanagement and technical stuff. But still, there are places where they agree and where they disagree, and that's what the article sets up. You try to compare like things as possible, and sometimes you get different answers. And I think part of that stems from what their particular audience is. What is it they're making a strategy game for? Who is their target market? Like, for example, strategy versus other genres. Paradox says, well, the focus of development tends to be more focused on making a working game world. Whereas you go over to Firaxis and they say, well, no, it heavily relies on underplaying a gameplay system and mechanics to convey the fun of the game.
Yeah, screw your world. We'll do that last. We'll make the game fun first. Then we'll throw some stuff on the map.
Wait, that's a revolutionary idea. The game's fun first?
What? Well, you also have to keep in mind, I mean, we have to frame this so that people who usually just play Civ don't get this weird idea about Paradox. The two types of games that are being discussed here, Civ versus, say, EU or CK2 or, you know, all of that stuff, they're actually two completely different games. Paradox does the grand strategy, more historical simulation style of strategy.
Yeah, I would go simulation. Yeah.
Where Firaxis does the, we pull from history, but that's just names and places and stuff like that. Everything else after that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's more of an abstraction.
Yeah,
Paradox seemed to be more focused heavily on you recreating history or only changing it slightly, while Firaxis is like way alternate history.
Reimagining.
Well, you can do alternate history.
But as we've seen from you trying to play the Cherokee,
they try really, really hard to make you suck.
Yeah.
The approaches are different. All of the games from Paradox tend to be mimicking history, and it does allow you to go beyond it, but it's more like, you know, it's an Earth map, or it's a map of Europe, or it's blah, 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 and, you know, all the pieces are there. And there's very detail-oriented in all of those, whereas Civ is more, basis is real life, but we've thrown that out because, you know, you're playing the Americans in 4000 BC. So build your own universe.
There's no one answer to how you make a strategy game, just like there's no one answer to how do you make eggs.
Exactly. So while they are very similar in using the word strategy, they're not necessarily the same approaches. For Paradox, making their world does make sense considering that they're trying to mimic the world first.
Yeah, that attention to detail where things are placed precisely, oriented just so at this particular point in time and relative to everything else.
Yeah, events that happened in real life pop up in game, so lots of historical digging and everything else.
Yeah, you get a little bit of that in some Civ scenarios, but not to the same depth that you would in a game where that's, you know, the whole point.
Yeah.
EU, of course, being New Europa Universalis, and CK2 being Crusader Kings 2.
Yeah.
And guess what? There was actually a Crusader Kings 1 and 3 earlier Europa Universalises. Imagine that, right? Weird. But they didn't just start off like calling their first title 4. I don't know, you know.
I thought they did. It's the first one I've played.
Blending systems together. Guess what? They also happen to disagree, Paradox and Firaxis, but this is not necessarily a bad thing. This is Firaxis. We like to start with a very simple approach for each new system, then add elements that tie in systems together as each mechanic matures. And Paradox is like, well, since our games are sandbox, it's up to you as a player to set your own goals and choose your own destiny, so systems that are fun give a real, reasonably historical outcome and then have the complexity that, you know, matches what it is that we're trying to do. So you might be thinking, do they agree on absolutely anything other than participating in this article? Yes. Playtesting systems. This is actually the one that I found the most interesting because it's kind of moving from disagreeing to more agreeing. You know, like Firaxis talks about, like the internal team is always playing the game from the earliest prototypes of the game, .. Whereas Paradox is like, it's something I see us doing a lot more of in the future.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Get around to testing our game later. Although, I'm going to point out that there was a sneaky compliment for Frankenstein in there from Firaxis.
Oh, yes, about the dedicated team of external testers. Well, I wasn't going to mention that because, you know, that's...
He didn't want to toot his own horn, but toot.
Oh my gosh, Mac and I used the exact same expression too, almost at exactly the same time. I knew we were on the same wavelength. Yay. Removing fun yet complex. They agree. Like, Paradox is like, if things that are too complicated are, in general, not fun. Yeah, like this thing called real life. And then Firaxis says, in general, if something's too complex, it becomes unfun pretty quickly. I'm not really certain unfun is a word, but okay, I kind of get what you're saying. Wishing to restore things. The idea being, you know, is there something that you removed just because it just didn't work? Firaxis is like, well, we remove very little. And Paradox is like, I can't recall any instance where it happened that a feature was removed for usability reasons that I wish we added. So in other words, if we felt that it would work and it was fun, we put it in. If it didn't meet these conditions, then it didn't. Simpler said than done, let alone people maybe agreeing that certain systems are fun or not. But it is their game. Yes, they're going to take feedback into account, but if they're making a game, then they're going to be making the decisions ultimately what to include and not to include. I know you modders are going to disagree with me, but you know what I'm talking about. Modding is a whole separate thing. I also like the patch versus expansion editions. There was a complete... Well, I'm editorializing now. There was a disagreement.
I'm not sure if it was disagreement. Just Firaxis is like, no...
But yeah, they're like, patches are a great way to make adjustments to systems, and expansions are where we put in new systems. And Paradox is like, if you choose not to buy any DLC, you'll still receive all the patches and game updates. Our goal is that regardless of what DLC you decide to get for the game, you should still receive the very best game that we make.
Okay, Phil? Phil?
F you!
Come on, get it in there.
F you!
You know why? Here's an exact reason from CK2. There's a sort of Islam, whatever, DLC. Basically, you can play CK2 as Western Europe, but if you don't buy the DLC, you cannot play a country that's Sunni or Shia or basically Muslim. Here's the problem with that. If those countries turn around and start converting other countries in your game, and you're not playing Iron Man or whatever, and you're bouncing around trying to change things, you can't play those countries. The game slowly progresses to the point where you have less and less ability to play the game because you're lacking a DLC.
Yeah, it's not very good.
Oh yeah, and the DLCs are not super cheap, and the game was kind of expensive to begin with, so... F you!
I'm not a fan of any DLC that allows players to play against others who don't have it either, and have an advantage because of it. I have encountered that in other games.
This rant brought to you by Imagine's Rage and supported by Phil's Tutelage. And then on the seventh point,
please send all hate mail to Dan Q anyway.
Yeah, I've got an inbox it can go in with giant air quotes. Suggestions for developers. In other words, you know, feedback. Firaxis is like, don't be afraid to revise and iterate on your game systems. And probably the most important thing of all, never underestimate the value of feedback. Sid Meier always says, quote unquote, feedback is fact. I've never actually heard him say that, but that's an absolute statement or absolutely problematic. I've said this before on the show, but okay. According to Firaxis, which means that your players tell you about the game is key to making your game a better experience for them. I think that's important there, for them, because sometimes we've seen suggestions for how to make a better gameplay experience, and we're thinking, well, for you, maybe. Paradox says, never do a feature without first thinking about how to visualize it and why it's fun for the player. The gamers should have the freedom to take their own choices, and they should be able to play the game again and again, where every game is a whole new experience.
And so basically, Paradox does the old school style of, let's pretend we're a fan of the game or we're a player of the game. Is this fun? Let's do a thought experiment. Fraxis says, hey guys, is this fun?
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder which approach has been working better.
Yeah, well, it's the old school versus the more interweb generation style-ish. Although Fraxis has been doing it long before that, but whatever.
And it's an interesting definition to, you know, having people playtesting your game before release from the community. I'm like, wait, didn't you just kind of say something a little different earlier in the article, both of you? But okay, I guess there are a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just because you have feedback internally from an external group doesn't mean you have to actually listen to it.
We feel like to say something right here.
Nothing I can get away with saying.
Yeah. That was perfect.
There's listening and not listening, and then there's also acting and not acting.
Yep.
Comments today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44121-288-7659. That's 44121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Before we do the usual goodbyes, as it were, this is actually a milestone episode for one of the members of the panel.
Mackie?
No. Phil?
Hi, hi.
You're old.
I know I'm old. I turned 30 not too long ago.
Oh, yeah, you're just so ancient.
Ancient.
Well, the fact that Phil doesn't realize this probably goes to support the fact that he's old. Which is, this is Phil's 100th episode as a regular co-host of Polycast.
Oh, God, what has become of my life? I mean, I self-congratulate.
Phil, Mackie, and I asked ourselves that some time ago, and quite frankly, you don't want the answer. And you were a guest co-host on episode 71 back in June of 2009, so it's your 101st episode overall, but the reason that you actually have been on 100 episodes is not because you've been a guest 100 times.
Yeah.
You're not an official member. Oh. You're just a guest.
We're still in a trial period. We're not sure about you.
Yeah. It's Dan's way of saying, yeah, you better buck up, buddy.
That's a long trial period.
Improve your content,
sir. Stop for a ride for a little bit longer than one might like.
I was going to ask Phil for a speech, but I think he already gave that with, you know, what's become of my life or whatever it was you said exactly. That was the speech.
Yep.
And it was very inspirational. I think Madgen's doing the math right now. Okay, so how many more episodes to 99? I know when I'm leaving the show.
Okay, at this point, we say no. And how soon do Dan get into quadruple digits?
The show would have to get into quadruple digits.
Well, yeah, true.
Well, let's see. Let's actually apply math to that.
He does have other shows.
Would actually get there first. There was, like, an episode without Dan, right? It happened before?
Wait, what is it? Taking us 6-7 years to get to the point where we've had 180-something episodes. So it's about 30 episodes a year. So, yeah, that's going to be a long time.
He does have multiple shows, so he can, you know...
You never know, we might make it.
We could do it! Civ 50, here we come!
8th season of the show, that's when we would have episode 200. That would take 8 years,
right?
So it only takes 5 more sets of 200 to get to 1,000. So, yeah, on 40 years... Oh, man.
Well, if they keep patching and changing the game every few months, then I guess 40 years is quite feasible.
So,
what would that be? Civ 10 by then, maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah, gotta be.
Well, it depends how many expansions and downloadable content there is for Civ 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah, that's true. It might get to the point where it's just titled Civilization, and they just update it over time as straight DLC.
As long as the world keeps having conflicts, I think there'll always be civilization. Cool, that's a bit serious.
We can do it. We can just keep going with Polycast until then.
40 more years.
40 more years. 40 more years.
No.
Well, Dan's the one who has to do it, right?
None of us could retire. We've all had, like, one of those permanent pacts signed.
Yeah, no. If this has happened, I'm dragging you. I mean, bringing the rest of you along with me.
Well, there's no backing out of the pact. There are consequences for trying to back out of the pact.
Yeah. Speaking about backing out.
Thanks for listening to the 185th episode of Polycast. I'm Dan Q, joined by our first-time guest co-host, Master Mishi.
Hello and goodbye.
Imagine.
Time to go.
The main team.
World peace and love is always the conclusion you get after total conquest.
And Makalua.
And by total conquest, he means I nuke them all.
It's been emotional, guys. Thank you.
Thanks for being... wait, emotional? Wait, we almost let you get away with that. I'm glad some people started to laugh. That's like saying experience was interesting.
Recorded October 19th, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.